Hi, it's Brock Romanek, editor of thecorporatecouncil.net. Welcome to today's webcast, Broadridge Speaks, Demystifying eProxy's Implementation. And I've decided to hold what I called an emergency webcast because there's been so many questions coming in regarding voluntary eProxy, as issuers are now realizing that it's available to them and they're grappling with the new rules that the SEC put out a few months ago. And Broadridge is so deeply involved in the process that thought we would amplify on the webcast that we held at the end of June and have our three senior Broadridge executives come on and explain more to us what they're doing and how they can help you. So Mary Ellen Anderson, who I've known for many years, is Vice President of Broadridge Corporate and Institutional Relations, is on the program, as well as Lyle Dampier, who's the President of Broadridge Financial Solutions, and Jim O'Regan, who's Vice President of Broadridge Client Services. So let me turn it over to Mary Ellen.
Thank you very much, Brock. You know, we at Broadridge have been very much involved with the new rule, you know, since we saw it published back in January, and we have been working with our staff, and we've been working with the SEC on a regular basis to keep them informed and obtaining advice from them as we've been working through this process. We've made a significant effort with the issuers, the banks, the brokers, and the institutions in an education program, you know, in that we've had regional seminars and webinars and speaking engagements, you know, throughout the country in trying to educate our constituents with regard to this rule and how they can benefit from this rule. So we find that this is a great opportunity and a challenge for us. And we specifically want to thank you, Brock, for hosting this webinar. We find that the more that we speak on this issue, you know, the questions are answered for the issuers and other constituents with regard to this rule. So thanks again, Brock. And we can start. Why don't you start with the question?
Sure. Thanks, Mary Ellen. So the first question is, and we're going to run through the agenda as listed on the webpage, which you got to access this webcast. But the first question is, what are some of the key factors that issuers should consider when looking at voluntary eProxy?
We think there's three factors, three areas that the issuers need to look at in order to make a decision about the use of notice and access. The rule gives them a lot of flexibility and a lot of choice, but there are three major factors they want to look at. The first is analyzing potential cost savings through the use of notice and access. We need to look at, or the issuer needs to look at, print costs, keeping in mind that as print volumes go down, unit print costs may actually go up, but the total cost of printing may go down. But the cost of postage should also go down through the use of notice and access by virtue of mailing lighter packages, that is, the notice only as opposed to a full set of material. The issuer also needs to make some assumptions and get some data, and we can help with that, and looking at fulfillment requirements, fulfillment not only for those shareholders that have previously consented to receive full packages, but those shareholders that might request material upon receipt of the notice. So there needs to be some estimation around that, particularly early on in the process. That's a little bit more of an estimation as opposed to hard data, but as the process goes forward and data is available to issuers, the estimation of that should be a little bit easier. The issuer would also want to understand to what extent they may want to use a hybrid approach where some shareholders would receive full packages and others the notice only. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. So looking at the cost savings as a factor, print and postage, as well as a hybrid distribution strategy. The second thing the issuer should want to look at is voting patterns and participation. And specifically, the issuer is going to want to understand agenda items that they have on their upcoming meeting, looking at shareholder proposals, understanding potential changes in discretionary voting, as well as things like majority voting for directors, so that they can evaluate the need for participation for not only institutional but retail holders as well. We think that's an important factor from an issuer's perspective. The general comments related to notice indicated that voting participation may go down if shareholders are receiving the notice only. So the issuer is going to want to be very conscious of what they're trying to accomplish with their upcoming meetings. They can also use or factor into their analysis the use of the second notice that's actually a votable form or reminder mailings under the traditional model. And the third component is looking at the change in timelines that the use of notice and access imposes upon issuers. Issuers need to have filed their material and be prepared to distribute it now at least 40 days before meeting date. And that is a little bit sooner than we would see on average today. On average, we think issuers are filing material 30 to 35 days before meeting date. Now it would need to be complete at least 40 days before meeting date. So they would need to begin the annual meeting process a little sooner than they have historically. So those are the three factors. Look, analyzing the potential savings, looking at the voting requirements and what they're trying to accomplish in this year's meeting, and then thirdly, understanding the impact on their timeline and process for preparation.
So from the issuer's perspective, what I've been calling the cost-benefit analysis, but it's really much more than that, what sort of factors should they be considering that the new requirements place on them?
From a probably the biggest issue I think that the issuers need to deal with is the timeline. The process changes somewhat, where it moves the sequence of events up in a different order. In particular, I think today, once the documents are finalized, there's the go to press, proofreading the materials, and getting it prepared for mailing. And under eProxy, the requirement is to have those materials posted on the internet 40 days in advance of the meeting when the mailing of the notices completes. So that's a different requirement and would require process changes at most organizations. As we've spoken with issuers throughout the country, what we've heard is that the 40-day requirement is the one that they find will be the most difficult to deal with based on the current process that they go through, based on the data as it flows through their organization. Of course, once the material is prepared, it needs to get posted to the internet, which brings the new electronic focus in place, where you know eProxy is really more of an electronic focus than a paper focus, as I think issuers were dealing with proxy materials in the past. In that electronic process, there's the document conversion, and again, as we transition from print mail to a notice and access, the online website becomes very critical in terms of how shareholders view the material, how they access the material. The website really needs to be very visually pleasing. They need to make sure that when people go to the website, they want to click through and see the material, which means it also needs to be logical. You know, each option clearly labeled so that people understand what they're looking at when they go to the website. And obviously, it needs to be intuitive. The experience now under Notice and Access is one more of self-service than ever before in the past. From a requirement standpoint, the issuer needs to have their material posted to a website in addition to EDGAR. Many have it on their website today, but due to the way websites are set up or the use of different IR firms, there are tracking cookies in place. And Notice and Access Rule specifically precludes the use of tracking cookies, which is really a privacy concern that you know somebody would be able to track who was accessing the material and who was potentially looking at it. So the SEC in the rule specifically precluded the use of tracking cookies. The material on the web also needs to be compatible with online reading and printing on paper. And both PDF and HTML formats accommodate that. Certainly XBRL, as that gets more widely used in the future, accommodates that as well. There's a lot of tools that are out there where you can enhance the viewing of materials on the internet, which can be considered to be used as well. From a rule standpoint as well, and intermediaries can point to the issuer's site or to their own site for the material. So when material is posted, when proxy materials are posted, they could be viewed by both beneficial as well as registered shareholders. Another requirement that the rule puts on issuers that choose to take advantage of it is the fulfillment requirement. Shareholders, through the meeting date, need to be able to request materials and have them delivered within 3 business days. And as a postage class requirement, if you will, that they need to be mailed by first class or equivalent postage class so that they can make it to the shareholder in time. That rule was recently clarified by the SEC. Originally, in the rule, the requirement was that it was 3 business days for 1 year following the meeting date. In the SEC's mandatory rule, which I think we'll get to a little later, they've clarified that to say it only needs to be sent within 3 days through the meeting date. After that, it needs to be sent, but there's no specific timing of when it needs to be sent. The area I think that we find the most conversation with issuers on, though, is print quantities. The people don't know how much they need to print, and depending on who they've spoken to or what their gut feel is, they come up with varying percentages of what they need to print over last year. And there's really 3 pieces to the print quantities that they need to pay attention to. The first is material elections on file. So shareholders, both registered and beneficial, have the right under the rule to be able to have a material election on file to say for all securities held in their account, they always want to receive hard copy sets of material. So that's the first component. The second is any stratification decision that the issuer may make. An issuer may decide that they want to send certain shareholders by different classifications hard copy materials, which obviously would need to be printed. And then there's the fulfillment question in terms of how many extra sets do they need to have in order to satisfy those fulfillment requests throughout the solicitation period as well as after the meeting date. What we've tried to do on at Broadridge is to try and take some of that mystery out of how much they'll need for shareholders that have material elections on file. Beginning last proxy season, we began asking beneficial holders if they wanted to receive full sets of material in the future, so that when issuers' record dates came up this coming proxy season, we would have an estimate of how many shareholders have requested full sets of material in order to help take the mystery out of it. As Lyle mentioned earlier, the fulfillment piece, again, at this point there's not enough experience to say what percentage of shareholders will be requesting material, but again, it's one area when we talk about print quantities where it's an unknown. There's still a savings opportunity available, but the exact print quantity is something that I think an issuer needs to give much more thought to than they ever had to do in the past.
Something I blogged about recently is that there's a lot of misinformation out there about what distribution options that issuers have. Can you talk a little bit about that, particularly that bifurcated approach?
Certainly. The rule does, again, give the issuer a lot of choice and flexibility in how they actually use notice and access. The rule specifically allows, and it's clarified in the mandatory release from this week, it allows the issuer to choose which share owners would receive a notice, which share owners receive a full package. The requirement under the rule is only that all shareholders receive either a notice or a full package. And the only exception to that is that share owners that have a prior consent to always receive hard copies, of course, always need to receive a hard copy. But other than that, the issuer can slice and dice or split their distribution in a variety of ways. What we're seeing today is issuers choosing generally to send full packages to high share amounts. For example, 20,000 shares and above, holders with 20,000 shares and above would receive a full package, others would receive a notice. Other ways that issuers have considered splitting their distribution strategy is looking at registered versus beneficial holders, looking at geographic splits. So for example, companies that have a high population of former employees or share owners where they're going to have the annual meeting may wish to send full packages to those holders that may attend the meeting in person. We're also seeing issuers consider sending full packages to share owners that have previously voted by hard copy. They want to make sure they get a physical voting form in their hands to continue to get that share owner's participation. And the last piece we're seeing is concern about foreign holders. We presented a timeline analysis to the SEC showing that in most cases, distribution of a notice to a foreign holder would preclude that foreign holder from being able to request a full set of material, receive it, and return a voting form in time for the meeting, given that there's only 40 days between the notice distribution and the actual meeting day. That said, we have seen some issuers send notices to all other than these prior consent holders, but generally issuers are taking advantage of their stratification either on the registered and or the beneficial side.
You know, there's one area, Lyle, that you may want to talk about here. We have a preference database in which we have accumulated email addresses for shareholders who wish to receive their materials electronically. We have accumulated these names through the years. So how do we deal with those shareholders' names that we have?
When we receive the records from the banks and brokers, those that for whom we have an e-delivery consent on file will continue to receive an e-delivery instead of either a notice or a full package. That also includes the institutions using our Proxy Edge voting platform. As Jim said, we do and are able to provide to issuers the number of accounts that have previously consented to receive full sets of material. We have a little over a million accounts that have consented to always receive material. That would break down into a smaller number, obviously, on an individual issuer basis, but we're able to give the issuer that number to help them in the print estimation process.
Great, thanks. Let's talk for a minute about the landing page concept that Broadridge has put together and how that will facilitate the ability for, investors to access the proxy materials and vote.
So just to start off, I'd like to let you know that the landing page concept has been discussed fully with the SEC staff. As I mentioned early on, we have ongoing meetings with the staff to keep them up to date, to get their advice and so on. And Jim, who is going to speak to this issue, is very much involved with the SEC on this concept.
Yeah, when we first started talking about the e-proxy, really what we're talking about is the change in default. So it's shareholders that have not consented to e-delivery and have not subscribed to any institutional voting platform. So we're really talking about the people that used to or have traditionally always received their proxy packages in the mail. So it's that change of default where now the issuer can decide to send them a notice of internet availability rather than a full hard copy set of material. And when we talked about the user experience and the concern around what a URL might look like, and the rule states that you need to provide to the shareholder where the internet address where the material can be found. And many URLs are, in the scores of characters. And the concern was if we were asking shareholders to type in these URLs with very, very long addresses, that the user experience really would not be a positive one. So when we came up with the landing page concept, what we thought was, in today's environment in e-delivery, when we e-deliver to a shareholder, it's a hyperlink to the material. They're able to simply click on something in their email inbox and go view the material. And we wanted to transfer that experience where they'd be able to simply click on a something on the web and then view the material. And that's really where the landing page came from. As Mary Ellen said, when we were designing and talking about the landing page, we had many different designs and different concepts of ways that we could provide value to the issuer and a good user experience for the shareholders. We ended up with the landing page that's out there today at www.investoreconnect.com, and it's really one place to go where shareholders can view their material and vote their shares and or provide a material election. And at that one place, it provides the functionality, simple functionality, where all they need to do is enter their control number. We then know which security they hold. We can display the appropriate links for them to see the materials, as well as offer the options under the rule. And the options for shareholders under the rule at that point is to view the material, to vote their shares, or to elect to receive future hard copy materials. So we think that the landing page concept makes that process simple for the shareholders. It's a good user experience, and it's one URL that they would always go to when receiving a notice in order to take advantage of viewing the material, voting, or electing to receive future hard copy materials. also consistent with the rule is, you know, that the site is free of tracking cookies. So we're not tracking who's coming to the site. Obviously, by entering the control number, we know what to display to the users. But when displaying the issuer's material, it's free of cookies, and they're able to view the materials at their leisure.
You know, Brock, I think you had a question with regard to our generic landing page and customized landing page, and where issuers would have to choose a customized landing page, and you had a concern about that. Well, the generic landing page that has been, you know, that we have in place can be used by any issuer, and everything is on that landing page that is needed. Some issuers have come to us and said, you know, they wanted this customized and that customized, so that's why we went farther. But the generic page could suffice for any issuer.
The one other comment I'd make is that there are some issuers may use their internal website or their investor relations website, some of which in addition are provided by third parties. It's common for the IR websites to use tracking cookies, and there's nothing inappropriate about that. However, under the notice and access rule, that kind of site cannot be used. Cookies need to be removed if issuers wish to report, point share owners directly to their internal website. So it's a concern or an issue that issuers should look at. Cookies can be removed in those websites, or they can use a separate website to conform to the rule requirements.
Thanks. Let's talk about the intermediary's perspective on e-proxy. I think it's useful for issuers to understand how the brokers and the banks are going to be approaching it.
From an intermediary's perspective, Brock, I think it's a regulation that needs to be followed. The intermediary doesn't have a choice, really, in the matter whether once the issuer determines that they want to take advantage of notice and access, the intermediaries must comply. The rule specifically precludes an intermediary from deciding to use notice and access if an issuer hasn't made that decision. So the difference between an intermediary's perspective and that of an issuer really is that from an intermediary perspective, it's a regulation that needs to be followed. From an issuer perspective, it's a choice. It's an opportunity to save monies. It's an opportunity to present shareholder materials in a different way, potentially. But both really have new responsibilities. And some of them are just setting up the job, if you will. You know, there's more and different requirements which need to be adhered to. More information needs to be posted so that people can understand what's being voted upon. The notice creation is something where, you know, traditionally intermediaries are forwarding issuers' material to their shareholders. In the notice and access model, the intermediary is creating a notice which is being sent to their share owners. And it's a subtle difference, but it is a distinct difference in the process from an intermediary perspective. And the issuer is no longer sending their material to the intermediary for notice shareholders. They're simply sending the information that needs to be sent to beneficial holders. So there's a transfer of responsibility, if you will. We talked about the preference database, maintaining the elections that shareholders have made that want to receive future hard copy materials. So it can be viewed as an extension of the preferences that are stored today. It's a little different, but you know, when we collect records, when Broadridge collects records from the various intermediaries with whom we support, we now have another option that we need to be able to store and report upon, both to the intermediaries as well as the issuers, and that is how many have elected to receive hard copy materials in the future. Once the notices are mailed, the processes that are required in order to receive elections from shareholders, we need to have available a toll-free telephone number, an email address, as well as an internet website in order for shareholders to request copies of the materials, either electronically or in hard copy form, as well as to provide their election to receive future hard copy sets of material. And all three need to be in place for all issuers, for any issuer that is deciding to use notice and access. There's the fulfillment responsibilities, which we talked about earlier, where once a shareholder requests copies of materials, it needs to be fulfilled in a certain time frame. And from an intermediary perspective, I think the management and reconciliation of dual processing streams under the same job creates some further complexity. In the traditional model, when an issuer's material was received, the intermediary or their agent, Broadridge in this case, would be able to take all of the records that were sent, have one print stream, marry that up with the material that's received, and then forward that on to shareholders. In today's environment, what we need to do, under notice and access, what we need to do is be able to print notices to anybody that has not elected, not affirmatively consented to receive electronic delivery, not subscribed to any institutional voting platform, and not placed a material election for hard copy mailings. The notices are mailed, and then when the materials are received, we then create another print stream for mailing of the hard copy materials to those shareholders that have either consented or fall under the issuer's stratification election of who they want to send hard copy material to. So the management and reconciliation of those processing streams, making sure that every shareholder received the materials that they have elected to receive or in the manner they've elected to receive, is another level of complexity. From an intermediary perspective, the level of development effort in order to process all of those items that I just spoke about is substantial. We've been, since the SEC released the rule in January, as Mary Ellen stated earlier, we've been meeting with the SEC, we've been meeting with the various constituent groups. We've put together a client working group to look at the various interpretations of the rule to make sure that we were consistent, that we were going to be delivering service to our intermediary clients and to our issuer clients in the manner that they expected, and obviously making sure that it was compliant with the SEC's regulation. And, you know, the last point that I'd make is the investment that needs to be made in order to put these processes in place and make sure that they're available and to make sure that they're scalable is something that we need to do irrespective of the take-up of the issuer community for notice and access. As an example, having an internet website available to be able to collect material elections from shareholders, to be able to collect fulfillment requests for material, that needs to be up, available, needs to be able to take, X number of hits per day, per week, per month. And at this point, the only thing we know is based on traditional proxy volumes, and we don't know exactly how many issuers will use and how many positions will use the traditional proxy model, and how many issuers or positions or shareholders, if you will use the notice and access model. So the scale of both models, both the traditional model as well as the notice and access model, needs to be built for complete volumes because it's an issuer choice, and an issuer can choose to use notice and access for this meeting and choose not to use notice and access or to use the hard copy or traditional model at their next meeting. So both need to be built to the total scale in order to make sure that we can service the community.
Before we go on to fees, Brock, there's one comment that we'd like to make about the education process. We've had 6 forums throughout the country, and we have 6 more scheduled, and we are having some webinars. We've had several, and we have several more scheduled. And, so I'd like to mention something that is frustrating the issuers out there, and that is the education piece to the shareholders. How are the shareholders going to know that the company is adopting notice and access, and they are going to receive an envelope with the notice in it? And what we've explained is that, this envelope we have come up with, you know, does say, or we have decided to put on the envelope that, you know, there are voting materials in this, and please open it. Please don't throw it away. But the issuers are very concerned about educating their share owners. So some of them have suggested that they may, you know, send a letter to their shareholders, you know, before they adopt or before letting the shareholders know that they are going to adopt notice and the reasons they are going to adopt notice, you know, and factor in the green, the environmental experience, the savings for the company and therefore the shareholders. So it is, just want to let you know that this is a frustration for the companies with regard to notifying the shareholders, you know, that they're going to do this. You know, they don't feel that the education is out there for the shareholders. You know, we have, you know, talked with the institutional shareholders and advised them, you know, through email and through other outlets, publications, but you know, I think there's still a need for the shareholders to be educated on this.
And I think, you know, in addition to doing a letter, obviously putting as much information up on the investor relations page for the company to explain what they're doing, I think would go a long way.
Right.
Let's talk about the fees. Since I first blogged your fee structure, I've had a number of questions, and I'm not sure that I got it completely right in my blog either. And so can you help clarify what that is?
Absolutely. As we look at the rule, the requirements placed on the intermediary for the current or traditional process don't change. Notice and access actually layers on additional requirements that the intermediary has to comply with, as Jim went through a few minutes ago. I also want to point out what I think everybody knows, but the fees that are charged today, the current or traditional fees, are set by the exchange, approved by the SEC, and they're actually the fees that are charged by nominees. Broadridge acts as an agent for many banks and brokers. We act also as their billing agent and bill these fees, but these fees are the nominee fees. In looking at notice and access, we've looked at a fee structure that Broadridge will charge nominees, and again, it's the nominees that have the right and ability to actually charge fees, including notice and access fees, onto the issuer. So I wanted to make that distinction. These fees actually are the nominees' fees that the issuer will be charged. Broadridge acts as a billing agent for many banks and brokers as well as a processing agent, and therefore we invoice fees at the bank and broker's instruction. Going to specifically to the fees, all current New York Stock Exchange fees will remain in place because all the processes will remain in place, whether an issuer uses notice and access, traditional, or a hybrid approach. Those fees have been set. They're periodically reviewed. They were last reviewed in 2003, I believe, and there were some changes downward in certain cases for nominee charges to the issuer. The notice and access will result in an incremental fee for all positions in a job, meaning all street positions, when an issuer chooses notice and access. Those incremental fees, which I believe were correct on your site, Brock, are a stepped fee structure. The fees range from 5 cents to 25 cents a position. It's a true stepped process, meaning that the first 10,000 positions in any issuer's job, regardless of total size, will be invoiced at 25 cents, the next 90,000 positions at 20 cents, and so on. There's a minimum incremental fee for each job of $1,500. These fees include the full functionality of the landing page, a base landing page, as Mary Ellen described. It also importantly includes any fulfillment transactions, both fulfillment because of prior election to receive full material, but also request to receive material once the share owners actually received a notice. So there are no incremental transaction costs, and therefore the total expense to the issuer becomes much more predictable. And that was one of our goals, as Jim said earlier. Issuers have had a lot of concern about potentially watching their savings evaporate because of high fulfillment requests after a notice has been sent, and the inability to predict that. We've tried to reduce some of that by collecting consent beginning this past proxy season, but more importantly, we made the decision to not charge incremental costs at all for fulfillment requests. As today, the issuer will remain responsible for any postage incurred, but there will be no incremental transaction costs. If the issuer chooses to use the so-called second notice option, which means they're sending a votable form to the share owner, those fees will be the same as today's so-called reminder mailing fee, which is 40 cents a position. Suppression fees will remain the same, suppressions meaning electronic delivery, proxy edge, or money manager processing from the brokers as examples. Suppression fees, however, will be reduced by 10 cents for issuers that have less than 200,000 positions. The current fee is 50 cents. The fee will go down to 40 cents in those instances where the issuer has less than 200,000 total positions and a notice is actually suppressed due to householding or broker special processing. We also charge what's called a non-standard stratification fee if the issuer wishes to break their mailing into different postage classes or wishes to split their file between full package and notice only. There's a 5 cent per position fee to do that analysis to create the separate databases, but there's a minimum or maximum of $500, minimum $5,000 maximum. The issuer will remain responsible, as they do today, for the pass-through expenses of print forms and any and all postage expenses, again, including fulfillment requests off the back end. The fees are tiered to reflect the actual work effort, regardless of the number of fulfillment requirements, regardless of the split of the file between full packages and notice, the entire set of functionality that's imposed upon the intermediary needs to be available for the entire duration of that meeting, meaning beginning at least 40 days before meeting date and extending till a year after meeting date. What we will be putting out on our site is the fees. The fees will be available on our website, and in addition, we're building a simplified model for issuers to be able to go in and look at the potential impact, the savings of notice and access. We will be using historic data, their previous or their most recent proxy mailing to get postage information, package weight information, number of share owners, and preferences on how to receive material so that issuers will be able to do some what-if scenarios on their own, and of course they'll be able to contact us directly for more detailed analyses. We do think that the net savings to the issuer are about 8 times the incremental fees looking at the print and postage savings on average. Some numbers, for some issuers it's higher, some lower, but there's very significant savings available to issuers. These fees do not include document conversion, web hosting, or warehousing if the issuer wants us to do that. And finally, I'd say that up till this point in time, the exchange and the SEC have together mandated the actual street side or beneficial fees that nominees charge. In this particular case, they explicitly declined to be involved in the fee setting process while acknowledging there's incremental work that needs to be done on the part of the intermediary and also the issuer. They declined to get involved in the fee setting process, and that brings us to this point.
Thanks very much, Lyle. So, I mean, one question I get is how were the fees arrived at? Can you give a little bit of background?
Again, I'd say the fees are the nominee fees, and the fees will be billed on behalf of the banks and brokers. But in looking at an approach to this, there's several components that need to be taken into account. One of those is to analyze the costs of the billing of the new requirements. Those costs include one-time expenses related to systems development. In Broadridge's case, we estimate about 55,000 hours of systems development that need to be put in place in order to provide the functionality required. There's also incremental capital that needs to be spent to improve infrastructure, fulfillment processing, and warehousing. There are ongoing expenses associated with notice and access related to transaction processing, not only the setup of the job and the notice creation. As Jim pointed earlier, the notice itself actually requires more information than the current vote instruction form that we produce. We have designed the notice so that it will qualify for the lowest postage class and cost available, but it actually involves twice the print output that a current vote instruction form has. There's also the fulfillment processing and the full package component of a mailing, assuming that issuers in some cases may stratify. So there's ongoing transaction costs. And there's the cost associated with managing these parallel job streams that Jim talked about. It adds a great deal of complexity to take a single set of records from banks and brokers and then split it into two parallel streams, full package versus notice, with different timelines, and make sure that at all points they reconcile properly, that voting is brought together properly at the back end, because the real output of this process is the voting that's done on behalf of banks and brokers to the issuer's tabulator. We also needed to look at the adoption and fulfillment rates. As Jim said a few minutes ago, we expect adoption rates by issuers to fluctuate over time, driven primarily by the agenda items they have in any given year. The issuer is not required to make a permanent election to use notice and access, and the distribution strategies from year to year, the percentage they get full packages versus notice, can change, as well as the option to use notice at all, and we expect that to happen. In addition, we've had to make some estimates around fulfillment rates. How many street holders will actually want material, and how will that fluctuate over time? We expect in high-profile meetings in high-profile companies that the fulfillment rates will probably be higher than in less widely held or less visible companies. We wanted to ensure that there's savings opportunities for all but the smallest issuers, and we say that because in the case of the smallest issuers, their total print and postage outlay is very small, and therefore the opportunity to get significant savings is reduced because the expense isn't very high, but we did want to ensure savings across the spectrum of issuers. We wanted to make sure that the interests of the intermediaries, issuers, and agents were aligned, and that is that shareowners receive material in the way they want to, that the issuers' needs, particularly around participation and quorum requirements, are met, and that intermediaries have the ability to consistently meet the requirements placed on them. We wanted to look at the risks associated with this. Again, as Jim said a few minutes ago, issuers have the choice as to whether or not to use notice and access, and they can make an informed choice with predictable expense based on the pricing strategy that we've put together. On the other hand, intermediaries have no choice. The functionality must be built. In the case of Broadridge, we serve many banks and brokers. We're required to build this functionality regardless of uptake. So the risk arguably is shifted to some extent from the issuer who has the choice to the intermediary that has no choice. And if we look at the total cost of building this out and supporting notice and access on an ongoing basis, we think break-even from a development cost perspective is about 50% of the street positions receiving a notice with low single-digit fulfillment requests over time. We do expect fulfillment requests to be in the low single digits. Our current experience, which is very early, is consistent with that. We think there'll be spikes occasionally, but if our experience were to be significantly different than that, that would also impact our view.
Great. Thanks, Lyle. Now that we do have the mandatory adopting release, I thought you might spend a second just giving any observations that any of you might have.
Sure. I guess what I would do is just go over some of the points of the mandatory rule, which was released in late July on the SEC's website. Effective January 2008, large accelerated filers, not including registered investment companies, must comply with the rule. Registered investment companies, persons other than issuers and issuers that are not large accelerated filers conducting proxy solicitations may comply on or after January 8th, but must comply on or after January 1st, 2009. And the only obligations, just to put that into perspective, the only new obligations that the revised model imposes on issuers is that an issuer who wishes to initially furnish a full set of proxy materials in paper using the traditional model, if you will, is now required to post those proxy materials on an internet website in addition to EDGAR, and they need to include a notice of internet availability of proxy materials with the full set or incorporate the notice information into its proxy statement and proxy card. During the voluntary period, there was a lot of discussion on the 40-day rule. We talked about it earlier. And in the mandatory rule, an issuer must comply with the 40-day period only if they intend to comply with the notice-only option. So an issuer can determine whether they want to do a full hard copy distribution. They have those new obligations put upon them, or they can choose to take advantage of the notice and access model, which is consistent with the model that's out there under the voluntary rule. If they choose to do notice and access, they then need to have the material posted 40 days in advance of their meeting. If they do not choose to use the notice and access model, their material needs to be posted to the website when they're distributing the information to shareholders. Also, in the mandatory rule, there were some clarifying amendments. An issuer or soliciting person must present its recommendation on how they would like shareholders to vote. Only if it chooses to make a recommendation on a particular matter to be acted upon by shareholders. Additionally, with respect to requests for copies of materials received after the conclusion of the meeting, an issuer is not required to use first-class mail and is not required to respond within 3 days, which the SEC clarified in the mandatory rule.
Great. Thanks, Jim. Well, I want to thank Mary Ellen and Lyle and Jim for doing this. This has been very useful, and I'm sure that we might be getting back to you in the future as there might be some new developments, and as you get some experience under your belt, and you've had some. You've already had, I think, about 10 issuers start to do voluntary e-proxy, but I'm sure there's going to be a lot more as we get further into the season. Thanks very much.
Brock, thank you very much. We really appreciate the opportunity to speak out about the notice process that we have been implementing. We have been doing this for about 12 companies and plenty in the pipeline, so we'll be glad to talk about our experiences going forward. Thank you for the educational opportunity here for the issuers.
Thanks. Have a good day.
Thanks.
You too.